All right, it's very, very good to be here with you and to start off our program season. So probably, if you haven't already gotten them, get the program brochure, because it just keeps getting better and better after today. I want to have a chance to just share a few thoughts with you, as is my habit, about a subject that I think is probably important to all of us who are here. Certainly those of us who have found our way to the ageless wisdom tradition, whether it's in the form of theosophy or whether it's in the form of any of the other avenues that address this sort of wisdom tradition that has been in existence as long as humanity has. Many of us who find our way to that find that we start to become acquainted very quickly with very broad, very expansive sorts of concepts, high ideas that demand a lot of thinking and a great deal of effort to try and suit ourselves to their understanding. It's effort that's well worth it. But one of the things that also can present certain problems is that very often it's difficult for us to distinguish how it is we apply these very expansive sorts of ideas. Where is it that the rubber meets the road? You could put it that way. And how do we do that? So I'd like to just say, and you know, just talk about that this evening. Many, many years ago, I just ended up writing about this, just a little short piece, because it came back to my memory. Many years ago, I had a lot of wonderful experiences, but one of them was, for a period, I was very much involved with Tibetan Buddhist group in Chicago and practice. And then many of the high teachers who would come through the Chicago area would often come and stay at my home. So on a given night during the year, you might have 10 of these lamas there who are going to do Tibetan Buddhist chanting somewhere. Full house, a lot of fun. One particular occasion, a gentleman was staying with me, him and his attendant. He was an old man, a very old lama from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. He was, the title was Rinpoche. So for those of you who are familiar with Buddhism, Tibetan style, Rinpoche is a title that designates someone who is a reincarnation of some past high teacher. I remember the first time I was exposed to the term was at the Dalai Lama had given it's called the Kalachakra initiation out in California. This is in 1989 or something. And they had a program. And I remember looking at the names of all the various people who were involved in the program. And as I read through the names, it was, you know, Mary Carter, Joseph Horowitz. And then there was this whole category of so-and-so Rinpoche, 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 Rinpoche. I was unaware, and to my mind, I'm thinking, wow, you know, this name Smith and Jones is common in America. But this Rinpoche thing, it's like they've really gone way out with it. Only later, of course, I came to find out it was a title and not a name. But anyway, this Rinpoche was staying with me at my home and his attendant. He was an old man, and unlike the many thousands who left Tibet when the Dalai Lama left, he stayed behind, as did most of the people in Tibet. But because of his position, he was also one that suffered greatly for that. He was imprisoned, and with the Chinese occupation of Tibet, he was imprisoned, tortured, and part of the process that he went through was what was described as a re-education process. So this re-education involved daily being brought out of his confinement, and then he would be walked around, and it was a circle of people who would be there. And they would hit him, they would spit on him, they would kick him, they would jeer him, all with the idea for him to give up this feudal superstition is what it was described, which is to say, your involvement with Buddhism. And so this is what he had to look forward to every day. And he found, he was describing this to me. He didn't speak much English. I spoke even less Tibetan. But he found a way to describe this aspect of his life history. And so he said he's faced with something. Now here he has this situation that he knows he has to deal with. How does he do it? You know, what is it in his teachings that prepares him to face what becomes his daily life? And so he said he tried different things. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's part of what happens is that there are many sorts of ceremonial initiations that take place. Enlightened beings, Buddhas, where you, part of the ceremony is that you become exposed to this particular enlightened being, and then part of it is you can then assume the identity of this great being. You can arise as this enlightened being. So he said he would go out there and he would try that. You know, so when they march him around the circle, instead of being there and being the Rinpoche who was being beaten, in his mind, he was this enlightened being. That was, so it wasn't Rinpoche, it was the enlightened being that was going through this process. He tried arising as different ones, even one time Yamantaka, which in this particular tradition is one of the really fierce ones. You know, he's described as a Vajra terrifier. So Yamantaka is said to be so fierce that when he comes to a place, even the gods run. So he arose as Yamantaka, and then they walked him around the circle. And he said he found that really this was not something that was effective. So he tried other things. You know, he had been had deep training in meditation. So he used different meditative techniques to try and divorce his consciousness from the body so that the body receives the blows, but the consciousness is elsewhere. He said that was not effective. So going through all of the various sorts of teachings that he had been exposed to, what he arrived at, he said that the most profound and the most useful of all of the teachings that he was exposed to was actually the most simple. And in his case, what that was a teaching related to love and compassion. So, you know, you have to kind of put your Buddhist hat on to embrace how it is that these things relate in this profound way. Because from the perspective of the Tibetan Buddhist or the Buddhist in general, it's a fact just as sure as the fact of gravity that reincarnation is just such a fact. So in that frame of thinking, every one of us has been here countless times. All of us have been. We've been here, we've died, we've come back countless times in countless different relationships to one another. So much so that the teaching would say that every one of us during some particular lifetime have been someone who has been a source of great benefit, great kindness to every other person that we meet. Even going so far as to say that each one of us in some particular previous lifetime has been the mother to anyone else that we meet. So you have been the one that was the source of the life, the nurturing, the well-being. So this is the sort of mind that is involved. So from that perspective, he found being walked around this circle, when he looked at each of the ones as they abused him, as they did, his thought process was completely different. He described it as, If, in fact, you were to be walking around a circle such as this, suppose you came home one day, for example, and your mother was there. And all of a sudden, the person who had been so loving to you started cursing you, kicking you, hitting you. What would be your response? Would you hate her for it? Would you want to destroy her because now she's treating you badly? Or would you take the mind that something profoundly disturbing has happened with the mind of my mother? And given this setting, she needs love more than ever before. That was the mind that he adopted. And so really his attitude in the midst of this abuse that was ongoing was more like the words that were said by the Christ on the cross. You know, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. They don't know the karma they're creating for themselves. They don't know the way that they're blocking themselves from the higher possibilities that exist within them. They just don't get it. But I do, and I'm in a position to forgive. So anyway, that was his approach. That was what he found in his teachings that made it possible for him to weather this ongoing storm and to come out inwardly undamaged and whole, really. He's a remarkable man. He's gone now. So, I mean, it started me to thinking. Hopefully, my hope is that nobody's situation is anywhere similar to what his situation was. But all of us have different things that we have to face during the course of our day-to-day lives. We have to figure out ways to deal with these things. And those of us who have some sort of deeper exposure to wisdom teachings, where do you go for your answers? I find myself repeating this quote. It's attributed to Albert Einstein, but a lot of people have said the same thing, that no problem that we face can be solved at the same level of consciousness where it was created. You pick a problem, its solution will not be found at the level of consciousness where this very problem was created. So, you know, the example I end up using, a bunch of them, you can pick one for yourself, but you take the example of war. You know, we've got a bunch of them going on all around the world. At every given moment, there are wars. So what is the way that we respond to violence? And where you have organized violence, well, what's the way we solve that? You develop a greater organization of more intensive violence, and you win. It's peace, is what they call it. And so you have such things as, you know, World War I, when it was fought, the slogan that justified this war was that this will be the war to end all wars. That was 1914. Unless they have taught me history wrong, it didn't work. It still doesn't work. And you go down the list. You continually have situations where hunger and starvation pop up in the world. Different places at different times. What's the answer? Well, if they're hungry, we'll give them more food. So, you know, out of the generosity of number of nations, they ship food there, those people get fed, and it pops up someplace else. And when it comes to the way that we approach our spiritual lives, you know, the unfoldment of those deeper powers within us, honestly, we tend to take the exact same sort of approach, which is to say, the moment we start to find that perhaps there's something more, that there's another way of seeing things that offers us a deeper sense of freedom, a deeper level of understanding, and we want to know more, what do we do? Well, we change the books that we've been reading and read different ones, and maybe more of them. We change the lectures that we've been going and hear different ones. You know, trying to address a problem at the level at which it is created doesn't work at any level. And so this is where we have to start paying attention and seeing what is the link between this other level of our own being and how we can actually embed ourselves and embrace that. In the Bhagavad Gita, you know, the Lord's song, which is really remarkable because Bhagavad Gita is the, you know, it's the source book of spirituality for many, many people worldwide. Gandhi, it was the one spiritual book that he needed. Actually, he was first exposed to the Gita through theosophists in London. So that was where he got grounded into that. But it's really just a small, if you look at the book that comes out of, the Mahabharata, said to be the longest poem in the world, it's just this little thin slice of this huge epic poem. But the Bhagavad Gita kind of paints the same sort of picture of a problem, the human response to the problem, and then it goes on to point ways toward genuine solutions. So it begins with Arjuna, the prince who has to go and fight a war. You know, it's not much more clearly delineated sort of problem you could find. He's going into battle. The armies are arranged. The horns are blowing. It's time to go to war. And the problem for him is that the enemy that he's going to have to fight and kill, that's what soldiers do, they are composed of many people who were his beloved teachers, friends, relatives. And even though Arjuna is a great warrior, looking at this, he gets despondent. And he tells his charioteer, you know, drive me up to the mountain. I just need to think things over. And then he starts pouring out his heart. Of course, it happens that his charioteer is Krishna, you know, the divine consciousness embodied. So when he starts telling his story, after he gets done with his pity party, then Krishna starts talking to him and says, to paraphrase, it's like, get a grip, Arjuna. You are a warrior. You have a dharma. You have a duty in this world. You don't kill anything to begin with. Everything that happens is mine. And so then he just shifts the conversation from this level to another level, totally different level. And out of that has come a spiritual tradition that has flourished for centuries. And a spiritual tradition that has also established a lineage of people who have been able to cultivate these same experiences. So for those of us who have found ourselves attracted to this very specific statement, restatement of the ageless wisdom that's called theosophy, there are some very strong points. I was talking about these very high ideas that also have very practical elements that are associated with them that are often overlooked. I mean, sometimes I think we take the thought and become disconnected from its practice. So I just wanted to talk perhaps this evening about a few of those. Actually, five of them. The way I see it, for those of you who are familiar with the history of the reintroduction of this ageless wisdom, in 1875, Helena Blavatsky was the one who started to restate these ageless principles, but in a way that was very much adapted to this time that we find ourselves in, this new turn in the cycle for humanity. It was an attempt to deepen the possibilities for us. So, the way I have come to see it, there are five very distinct things that were introduced at that time. I tend to regard them as seeds that were planted in human consciousness. Much like any seed that is planted, when it goes into the ground, it takes time for it to mature, for it to come to fruition, and for it to actually ripen. H.P. Blavatsky and the people who were around her had no illusions whatsoever about believing that the things she had to offer would be understood during her lifetime. More than once, she made the statement that it wouldn't even be until the 20th century. She was talking from 1875. But it wouldn't be until well into the 20th century that these things could even be intelligently discussed. So, you know, if I can, what I would like to do is just present to you, you know, these five seeds and also speak perhaps about some of the ways that they can actually be made practicable, that they can actually be rooted in the life that we find ourselves living from moment to moment out here in the real world. So, the first one, and the most important of the ideas, these seed ideas, was the idea of unity, of oneness. In the theosophical way of speaking, it speaks about the universal brotherhood of all humanity, the linkage. You have to keep in mind, too, these were ideas that were presented in 1875. So, to us, in the year 2015, the idea of a universal brotherhood of some type has become really the law, international law. I mean, there is no justification for any sort of discriminatory practices among human beings that's justified by international law. This is something that has evolved over time. In our own country, you know, in 1875, slavery was a very recent memory. You know, the idea that you could own and have the papers for another human being was an idea that was, you know, just, you know, what's the problem with that? This is how we do it. And, you know, so Blavatsky, in introducing these ideas, it was in a period of colonialism, and for another nation to set up camp in some other people's territory requires this sense that in some way we are superior and somebody else is clearly inferior. And that was just the mindset of that time. So to say that, no, this is not true at a social level, but even at the more profound level, the reason why it is not true is because we all share a common source. That the very thing that animates every single person is the exact same thing. There's no separation. It was a radical idea. So it's an idea that we still find ourselves growing into. But in terms of its practice, you know, how do you practice unity? It's a nice idea. I mean, you say it and everybody kind of shakes their head and agrees. What is the form that makes it something that finds its way into the world? that finds its way into your relationships with other people and, you know, with the planet. So, again, one of the little books that Blavatsky wrote was a book called The Voice of the Silence. Many of you are familiar with it. Short little poetic book. Something that said in there that I struggled with for many, many years, trying to figure out, you know, what it really means. Little quote that says, talks about compassion. And what it says is that compassion is no attribute. It is the law of laws. Compassion's no attribute, it's the law of laws. Well, that's a pretty sweeping statement. Because I know a few laws that, you know, karma, let's start there. Compassion, more a law of laws than karma. You know, the law that there are cycles that govern the appearances and disappearances of people, of worlds, of universes. You know, these cycles of breathing out into existence and breathing in into pralaya. And compassion is greater than that law. So it's something I had to give some thought to, because conventionally, when we think of compassion, we think about acts that we do, or a state of mind that we generate. One way of defining compassion, particularly in Buddhist tradition, is the idea that compassion is the desire to relieve the suffering of other beings. And so that's good, but is that the law of laws? I feed somebody who's hungry and that's the law of laws? So, it's taken a little bit of work, but if you look at it, when we find ourselves in that state of mind or in that habit of activity that we can describe as being compassionate, what is it that's going on? You know, what's happening at that time? First of all, there has to be some sort of perception of suffering in another. You know, we see that somebody has a need. And then somehow or another, the desire within us arises to alleviate, to speak to the need of another. And so what is it that actually happens? Whereas previously, the range of our thought, the range of our activity, was confined within the sphere of me, didn't go much farther. Now I find myself going out. So the center that was isolated here enlarges in this process of compassion. So extend it. Now, all of us can be compassionate to the people that we love. And my daughter has a problem. No problem. I'm there. You know, I'm on this. My wife, you know, my little family. That part's easy for all of us. Some of us, we go a little bit farther. You know, we can go to our extended family, our neighbor. You know, every now and then you get somebody who goes out to the nation. You know, they become a patriot. But when we think about the people in history that we would describe as the greatest among us, the feature that seems to characterize them all is that they had this limitless compassion, that they embraced all beings. All of it was contained within them, without the sorts of divisions, without the sorts of distinctions. You talk about Jesus, you talk about Buddha, Krishna, and you know, you can step downward even. You know, you talk about people like Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King. There are stages of elevation in this process. But the ones we would describe as great have developed this compassion in a way that the limits and the boundaries and the borders that we think of as normal, natural, somehow dissolve. And it's through this process of dwelling. It begins almost in imagination when we're talking about the practice of compassion. So what compassion is, you could say, that makes it the law of laws, is that when it is extended to its extremes, really what you're talking about is the law of oneness. All limits cease, but it begins with the person in front of you, spreads to the next. So what's the practice? The practice could be in imagination. But the beauty of imagination is it has a way of becoming real. I think it's the poet William Blake. He said, "Everything that is now real was once imagined. The chair you're sitting on, the clothes that you wear, you know, everything was once imagined." So we imagine ourselves into a state of action. And this is sort of the way that this becomes practical for us. Conscious, selfless activity flows from this practice of imagination, compassionate imagination. So anyway, that's this first of these five seeds. The second one that H.P. Blavatsky brought back to the attention of the world was the idea that we are living in we are multi-dimensional beings living in a multi-dimensional universe that is characterized by intelligence. So in the theosophical tradition, we tend to speak about seven planes of being, or oftentimes it's even said the seven bodies. So you have the physical, the etheric, the astral, the mental, you know, those sorts of divisions. So, you know, this is something that's familiar to all of us. I mean, all of us are aware when we get stuck with a pin that there's a sensation that is in fact physical. You know, the pin sticking us doesn't begin as a thought. So we're familiar that there is the physical element. You get stuck with a pin and it's like you can get angry at your stupidity for sticking yourself. So there's the emotional aspect of anger. And then there's the thoughts that come. Oh, will I get infected? You know, from the stupid activity that caused me pain. So you've got physical, emotional, mental that we can see in almost any act that we find ourselves involved in. But because we tend to be a little bit inattentive, it's something that, you know, we just think of it as one thing somehow. So the practice involved in this awareness of the multidimensional nature of ourselves and others is really one of self-reflection, self-observation. There's a little meditation that many people do and relates to this idea. Sometimes it's described as a meditation on the bodies. So we meditate in this way. You know, you sit and you find yourself quiet and you begin by just observing the physical body. You know, you feel what you feel. If you sit and if you're quiet enough and nobody's bothering you, you'll feel the currents of the air in the room, you know, passing over your skin. You know, you'll feel the pulsing and the flow of the blood if you get quiet enough. Some people even describe how they feel the currents of, you know, nerve energy even flowing in the body. If you get quiet enough, you'll feel different sensations. So the idea with this meditation is, you do that. Take time to get quiet. Notice what you're feeling in the body. And then tell yourself, well, the fact that I am noticing this tells me that I'm more than this body. So the idea is that then you make this affirmation, I am not this body. I'm something more. And then you notice, you know, you move on up. So then you have the emotional field. And so all of us, at any given moment, there are all sorts of emotional currents going through us. Oftentimes we, again, are not aware. It's just sweeping over us and we're not paying particular attention. So in this particular moment of quiet, you observe that. You know, you feel that perhaps you're feeling inwardly heavy or inwardly light. You know, that there's some sort of something arising in you that's lifting you up. You notice these things. And again, because you're able to notice, because there is something that is not tied up in this, these emotions, this is not me either. And then you do the same thing with the thoughts, you know, which can be a little bit tricky because they seem to go like lightning and to the point that it seems like it's a stream of thoughts. You know, how do you separate it? How do you see a thought when it's just this constant flow? But if you find yourself getting quiet, one of the things that anybody who does this over a period of time will be able to tell you, and you probably have your own experiences, that you start to become aware that there's spaces. You know, the thoughts are really going across the screen of the mind, much like clouds go across the sky. And, you know, we'll lock on to a particular cloud and see all the nice shapes in it and just follow it and follow it and follow it. But you don't have to. And so this is the process. So once you strip away from these things, then you start to become aware that in fact, beyond the thought, beyond these clouds, there is an all-embracing, all-encompassing sky. And that becomes the area of your exploration. All of this stuff is experimental. And quite honestly, I like the way the Dalai Lama approaches it, where he says, we have the very best laboratory. You know, you NASA, with hundreds of millions of dollars, couldn't put together a better laboratory than the one we have of this body and this mind to experiment. So we need to do it. You know, why have a multi-million dollar laboratory just sitting there doing nothing? I should say too, I was with the Dalai Lama, this is years ago, the same time I learned about Rinpoche's. And he talked about his own experience. Apparently as a kid, he was somebody who, he was a tinkerer. I mean, so much so, he liked to, he was mechanical. He liked to take things apart and hopefully put them back together, but at least take them apart. So much so that as a young man, he had them, you know, there were no roads to drive a car up to the palace, the Potala Palace in Lhasa, Tibet. So he had them kind of bring a car up to him so he could take it apart. He tried the same thing with a watch. And I remember he was describing how he took it apart, trying to put it back together. Didn't work. He said he tried again. He said, one of the problems with Tibetans, he said, we have a short temper. He said, so he tried it again. It didn't work. He said he tried it a third time. And I couldn't believe that he said this. So he says he hits the table, the watch goes bad, and he says, son of a bitch. He said that. I'm not making that up. You know, it was at that moment I said, I can listen to this man. But the idea for him was, he was talking about anger at that point and its effects. But for him, it was also this process that now you observe something and you see its effects and you track it through. So that was something that he added to that. So this is how we deal with this whole thing of multidimensionality. This is how we practice in ways that can become meaningful. What's the value of it? I mean, you find yourself with someone, and, you know, somebody is going through the variety of experiences that life brings. Very often, we find ourselves judging the total person based on some momentary expression of anger, or based on some flawed type of thought, or oftentimes just based on the way they look, you know, right down to the physical body. I don't like them because they look like that guy in kindergarten that I didn't get along with. So you become able to recognize how your own consciousness is functioning. And this is an important tool, necessary. Third thing is, the third one of these seeds, is the idea that there is no empty space. It's something that's a very familiar idea, just at the basic level of contemporary science. Anybody who's sitting in this room who has a smartphone, you know, we all know that invisible to us, there are organized patterns of energy that if we turn the phone on, could express in countless YouTube videos, could express in conversations with someone around the world. And it's all right here now, but we don't see it. But that's just at the level of pure physical science. In the Mahatma letters, there's a very, there's a phrase that I very much like. I like the way it sounds, but also what it says. And what it says is this, that from moment to moment, each one of us is in the process of peopling our current in space. We are populating our current in space, that there is an streaming from us from moment to moment is this current of thoughts, of emotions, of all various sorts of qualities. And that by virtue of our thoughts, by virtue of our lack of control or healthy control of the emotions we cultivate, this current is becoming populated. Everywhere we go, we've got a crew that comes with us. You know, the best rappers in the world don't have a bigger posse than we do. Moment to moment, we're developing this population that travels with us so closely, that affects the world around us so completely, that, as the expression goes, who you are speaks so loudly that I can't hear a word that you're saying. This current that we cultivate of an unseen nature. And so this is something that we need to also become aware of. You know, as long, there's an African saying, and what it says is, the disease that is hidden cannot be healed. The disease that we hide from ourselves, that we are unwilling to look at and to recognize, cannot be healed. And so the process that we, you know, that I'm talking about is this process of choosing to become aware. We don't have to. Eventually we do. But sometimes it's better to choose. And in the words of the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, it enables us to avoid the misery that is yet to come. So, space, no empty space. What's a practice? You know, how do we engage with that? Again, one of the things that I find myself talking about quite a bit these days is something that's probably familiar to everybody here, but may have slipped away from you over time. And it's the practice of something that's the basis of most of the world's religions. And it's a simple thing called prayer. Very often it's shunted to the side in favor of the more new age and upscale meditation, which ultimately converge in ways that they are indistinguishable. The process of quieting the mind through sitting and simple awareness, or the process of quieting the mind through the expression of our deepest hopes, aspirations, really, prayer in its most essential sense is simply the recognition of what is. That's what it is. It's not what you say. It's the recognition, and sometimes taking the form of words. Ultimately, that approach to the divine or to what is real leads us to stillness. We stop talking and perhaps even listen. And at that point, meditation, prayer, tell me the difference. But again, this is one of those practices that perhaps is more available to some. Everybody is not cut out to sit cross-legged, focusing on the breath for an hour at a time or 20 minutes at a time. It's not the thing that everybody necessarily, by temperament, is most suited toward. Not to say that it cannot be cultivated, it can. But for many people, the process of expressing themselves in this way is something that leads actually to this sort of stillness. And it also affects this, current that we are peopling the space around us with. Fourth of these seeds is something that's pretty basic. The idea that, one of the things that H.P. Blavatsky presented was this idea of self-responsibility. That nobody is responsible for the state of our thought, even for the state of our being. There's a little book, storybook really, called The Idol of the White Lotus. It's a beautiful little story about, it goes back to something in Egypt. But in there's something called the three truths. And one of those truths speaks about this idea of self-responsibility. That it says, each one of us, each person is their own absolute lawgiver, the dispenser of glory or gloom to themselves, the decreer of their life, their reward, their punishment. Each one of us is that person. You have to be a little careful with that, because very often it goes into that realm of karma, that what you get is what you deserve, which you, because you're being mistreated, you must have done something for this to have earned this in some past life or this life, which can be a little bit simplistic. I mean, the fact of the matter is that planes drop out of the air, boats go down in the water, and each of the hundreds of people involved in that incident did not kill somebody in an immediate past life and earn this sort of fate. The fact that we live in a nation, anybody born into that nation inherits the karma of that place. Whether you were a good guy or a bad guy, we participate in the life of this greater body within which we live and move. So, in terms of the practice that relates to our taking responsibility for ourselves, it begins with actually first an analyzing. We look at it, see if it's true. And then if we find that there are truths there, we make choices. Conscious. Bringing it to consciousness is what all of this is about. And the last of these five is this idea that there is such a thing as spiritual evolution. You know, we all know about the normal concepts of evolution that take on the Darwinian sort of shape, that forms evolve and that they evolve through natural selection and survival of the fittest, so that's how we get the better forms that exist. From the perspective of the theosophical view, the ageless wisdom view, that's a truth, that forms do evolve and they utilize these sorts of mechanisms. But there's another truth at play simultaneously. And that's the fact that every form is inhabited by consciousness. And the expression of the consciousness assists in the development of the forms that will be most suitable for its level of development. So the form is influenced by the consciousness. And that consciousness also unfolds. There is this idea, you know, that I am a spark from the eternal flame, you know, or that in some way, who we are at our deepest level is inseparable from the divine. That's the thing that kind of drives us into this exercise of spirituality. That somehow or another, some point along the way, we have recognized in ourselves something more profound. And it is of such a nature that it demands of us, as much as we may try and get away from it, it demands that we pay attention to it, that we try to discover those ways to unfold and to cultivate it. So, for this sort of spiritual evolution, practice, you know, if I were to describe what the practice is, I would describe it as remembering, in the sense that there is something that is very present within each and every one of us that somehow or another we have managed to lose sight of, to forget. And in that process, we find ourselves kind of lost in the normal sorts of unhappinesses and lonelinesses that we experience and call a life. So in this process of remembering, somebody was here at our convention. He gave a good example. It was a hot day. So he was saying, imagine it's a day like this, real hot. And you find yourself thirsty. And you know, if you can just do this imagination exercise, you go to your refrigerator. And there's a nice cold lemon in there. And you look and you say, I'm going to make some lemonade. You get the lemon out and the skin is sweating in your hand and it's cold. You cut it, you go to squeeze it, you smell the lemon. And he stopped there. He said, by now, if you've actually been following this through, your mouth is already watering. If you follow it through in your mind, you start to salivate. A similar process we can engage in this process of remembering. One of the ways that many people approach it, calling to mind whatever it is they think they know about one of these beings we would describe as one of the great ones. So depending on your tradition, you call to mind the life of Jesus. You call to mind the life of the Buddha. Theosophical tradition, it might be the masters of the wisdom. You call to mind, you think in terms of that. You imagine the nature of this very, very, the greatest thing that you can imagine. And in that process, inevitably what you feel some sort of expansion that takes place. Somehow or another, we feel enlarged, bigger, which is always one of the telltale signs that we are engaged in something real. If you find yourself shrinking, tightening, turn and look the other way. But this process of remembering is a process that speaks of unfoldment. And so that's something that we engage in. So these are these five, and the sort of practical approach to them all. In a way, they're also antidotes. You know, just like good medicine, you take it for particular sorts of ailments. All of these, they speak to sense of alienation, powerlessness. You know, people who find themselves functioning in a world where it seems like there's no meaning, meaninglessness. You know, all of these things address these common ailments in the process of addressing our own unfoldment. So if it's all right with you, I think that's about what I have to say for tonight. But I appreciate your attention. It's been very kind of you all. Thank you.
Thank you. So you said earlier on that you saw prayer and meditation as being the same thing. Mm-hmm. However, in prayer you're talking and in meditation you're listening. Mm-hmm. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah.
Please.
Maybe I didn't express myself well. I view them in terms of their, in terms of the ultimate goal. At a certain point when you pray, you stop talking. Again, I should give you my favorite definition of meditation. Meditation is not what you think. So at the point at which we move beyond the process of thought, we are meditating. In the meantime, we're practicing meditation, which generally means that we're thinking about different things in different ways. Prayer, commonly regarded, is speaking to God or to the divine. But at a certain point, words fail us and we fall silent. And so then it's also the same phase of not thinking, no thought. So at the apex of meditation practice and at the apex of prayer practice, you find yourself in that state of So in that sense, I view it as paths up the mountain.
My question is, in the beginning you stated that Blavatsky kind of pointed out that her teachings or this message she was bringing to the world would not be really understood maybe until in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that even though she opened this door, that there's a continual expansion of that age's wisdom, and how do you see that expansion into the 21st century?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Clearly, what she was trying to bring and what she was trying to describe was the expression of wisdom that we were capable of grasping. You know, that humanity, from time to time, our abilities to grasp this increases. And in that, along that line, there have been extensions to the message that Blavatsky brought in. I mean, certainly when you look at, you know, someone like immediately after she passed, you had an Annie Besant who took Blavatsky's message and described it in a different way and tuned it in a different way for a different audience of people. So it spread in that way. Theosophical Society itself has had many groups that have broken away from the original. So you have, you know, about 5, 6, 7 different Theosophical Society. Always it was a breakaway that occurred because a particular individual became so deeply imbued in an insight, you know, some profound insight into some aspect of this ageless wisdom that required a different way of expressing it. So it has expanded in that way. So you have a Rudolf Steiner who went into, you know, started the Waldorf schools and the Anthroposophical movement. You have a Krishnamurti who cultivated a different approach to the ageless wisdom. So its branches, its roots have spread since its beginnings. And so I think in that way, it's something where we find ourselves now in the 21st century at a time when conditions are conspiring for this wisdom to become quite pronounced. Not just because it's present. I mean, you take an example. You go to the dictionary, any dictionary from the year 1900 up to maybe even the 1950, 1970, you couldn't find the word karma in the dictionary. Now, you know, children's dictionaries have the word karma. Now you go to a grocery store in Wheaton, and you probably don't know much about Wheaton, but people ahead of you in line will be having a conversation, and karma will pop up in the conversation. So that kind of groundwork has been laid. A lot of these concepts have made it into the popular culture. The deeper aspects of it are still waiting to be experienced. But one of the things that I think is happening, and I find myself talking about this more and more, you know, I would like to feel that as a humanity, we have the capacity to see the need and respond by choice. I think very often what ends up happening is that we find ourselves in crises, and then we're forced to respond. Right now, as a human family, we find ourselves faced with multiple crises, quite imminent. And unless some sort of action is taken, quite unavoidable. And so that's the opportunity. And so that's why I find myself more and more trying to talk about these avenues that put us in touch with something beyond the level of the problem. Because otherwise, we're just rearranging the furniture in the exact same room. So when I talk about crises, you know, it's the obvious things. You know, we're going to have to come up with some sort of way of addressing the fact that the waters, the air, the sea, the land is intensely polluted in ways that are affecting living beings that have a direct effect on us. And we're going to have to do something about various sorts of imbalances, social imbalances. All of these things are having profound effects. And it seems as if, again, there's a convergence taking place. And simultaneous with this conversion is this upwelling around the world of people, you know, like us here in this room, where the upwelling is of people who are looking for and recognize that there's something much more that's capable to be grasped and experienced. You know, it's not on the news, but everywhere I go, and I travel quite a lot, there is not a place that I go where I do not run into those people who have this profound awareness that there is a greater life to which we have a responsibility and which lives through us. And many people are finding themselves deeply informed by this greater life right now. And that's something that, you know, I find myself speaking about this because it's the opportunity that's open to all of us. If we would just pay attention to the things we already know. You know, there's no new information you need. There's no new piece that has to be added. If we can just pay attention, look in the direction of that which has been inspiring to us, which has lifted us up, where we have found those things where we have felt this sense of expansion, and do something with it. And what you find is that that leads you to the person who was right next to you, you didn't even know, who has a similar sort of activity and interest. And this network is created. It's forming very fast anyway, but it would be very good if we could choose to participate in a conscious way. That's the point, really. Because otherwise, we're just driven along. You're blown by the wind. You know, you may get there, but it's not because you want it to. And it makes a big difference. So that's why I talk the way I do these days, and that's, I hope that answers the question.
Thank you for sharing those five seeds. I pretty much understood all five of them, but one I was little, not much clarity on this. There is no such thing as emptiness.
No empty space.
Empty space. So in my understanding and experience is that as we go deep in meditation, we end up in like emptiness and empty experience, because all the mind chattering, thoughts and emotions and physical sensations, it's a lot of crowd, you know, in the beginning. As we go in the meditation, it all ends up in like a silence and stillness. You know, I'm relating that as a empty space. Mm-hmm. Even from the physical level, like electrons and atoms, you know, there's a lot of space mm-hmm. is there, and there is a lot of energy activity going on in around the atom, but there's a lot of empty space. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of empty space in there. So maybe I misunderstood that no emptiness or empty space you're referring to. If you can clarify a little bit, I appreciate that. Thank you.
No, what I said was that there's no emptiness, because that's emptiness is a very specific word for a specific sort of experience. There is no empty space. Space, no matter how we regard it, is filled, and you could say minimally filled with consciousness. It's pervaded by consciousness. And, you know, the fact that we find ourselves entering into and opening up to new dimensions of consciousness within ourselves, to the point that we find that what has been familiar somehow gets left behind. It's very much like the example of the atom that you gave. You know, to go beyond the sphere of that atom is not to find ourselves in an unpopulated space. Within my body are countless trillions of atoms. To say that you're in that vast space between them, you're still functioning within this body. Although our awareness, the cultivation of our consciousness only extends so far, so it seems empty.
So holistically, there's no empty space.
Emptiness is not, empty space is not possible. But, you know, we explore it and then we find out if that's, you know, I'm going to look to you to explore it and come back later and say, you're wrong, man. I tried it, you're wrong. Tuan Tri.
I ask you this question, if I understand you about you saying that there is no emptiness, empty space. For example, we all are affected by other people's thoughts and feelings. So when I am here, everybody else have thoughts and feelings, and it run around, and I am affected. And yeah. In this room, for example, there are all kind of thoughts and feelings. Yeah. There is no empty space.
Yeah, that's the idea. And it can be, the idea actually, if you follow it through, it's even more specifically developed. In the sense that, you know, not only is there no empty space, but there is, you know, very intelligent patterns of energy, you could say. So almost you could say we are surrounded from moment to moment by beings. You know, devas is the word that would be used in Sanskrit language, that there are beings of light. Equally, there are beings of darkness. There's all of that around us from moment to moment. So the important thing is awareness of that fact. You know, all of these five things join together. So if we have this awareness, there is no empty space. We have this awareness that there are a variety of different types of lives that we function around and within. Some people take the idea that, well, I need to explore, you know, both sides. And very often, I was with a lady earlier this week who had somehow found her way into some sort of meditation practice. She had no teacher. She had no one to kind of give her guidance in any of it. And she found herself, you know, what she called practicing meditation in ways that were exploratory of things that she shouldn't really be exploring. And so for months now, she's found herself very unsettled, disturbed by whatever it was that she connected with. So that's something, a choice that was made, but an ignorant choice. She didn't know. So we know no empty space, but then at the same time, we're responsible. We have to make active choices. So we choose that which is the most effective, which is the most beneficial. And so these two things. It's great to know there's no empty space, but so what? Then we have to do something about it.
Yeah. Okay. I have one more question about meditation. Maybe it's out of what you were talking today. Mm. But my question is this. There are many kind of meditation, and some people prefer to like building characters, mm-hmm. and some other people prefer just thinking about nothing. Mm-hmm. What do you think that is better?
Well, I would never say that any one of them is better. Depending on the person's own unfoldment, some of them would obviously be not worth their time bothering with because it's either something that's beyond or beneath. But all of them, and again, we're talking about meditation practices, not meditation. All of them have the capacity for us to move beyond the constant domination of the thought and the mind.